Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. First, hearing the voices and stories of individuals can help us better understand a region's history and its people. Historian Lindsay Lee has made it her life's work to capture the oral histories of Martha's Vineyard residents. The third volume of The Third Vineyard Voices, Words, Faces, and Voices of Island People came out this summer. Lindsay Lee, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This is your third book and third decade archiving islanders' oral histories and their portraits. Where did this idea come from?
It came from when I moved to the island in about year-round, about 1971, and had did all the different jobs people normally do, cleaning houses, shucking scarves, working at the Scottish Bakehouse. I wrote a book about plants, too. So all along the way, as I met people and the stories that they told me, just in passing, you know, these sort of subjective, quixotic stories brought the history of the vineyard alive to me in a way. I'd read all the right history books, but these stories helped me understand the vineyard so much better. So I thought I should start collecting them.
Mm. You write in the introduction to the latest book that people tell stories as a way of explaining how things came to be. So talk about the role of storytelling as a means of passing down history.
I think storytelling is, it's a strong way to pass down history. It's the way people, it preserves history, but it also alters history. You know, I think one of the things that I think is kind of the beauty of oral history collecting is that you realize stories and people's memories are subjective. They are influenced by their audience, their mood, who's asking them the question, what the day is like. So I think storytelling is a way for people to encapsulate them some issues about their lives. Mm-hmm. But it also is a way for us, through the kind of variations of stories, to understand that rich, complex web of life and of experiences.
So. Are there people you've heard about or knew that you wish you'd been able to interview and record but passed away before you had that chance?
It's a story of my life.
Oh, no.
you know, this is a perfect career for a guilt-ridden New Englander. Each week I open up the newspaper and there's somebody who I had meant to interview, I'd done maybe one interview with and we're going to do more, or that I hadn't been introduced to. So, yes, there are many people.
All right, so we have a number of voices and stories from this third volume of Vineyard Voices to share with listeners. Let's start with David Crohan. Give us an introduction to David.
David is an amazing person. He's a musician, a pianist mostly, but he's been blind since birth. And in the book, you'll hear a story about his time on the vineyard, but in the book he talks a lot about his growing up and going to Perkins Institute and the challenges of the kind of different musical theories, which I knew nothing about. And then he established David's Island House on Martha's Vineyard, which was a real hangout for people.
I was hitchhiking with this girl up to Menemshe, and this couple picked us up, and I had been here maybe 3 years or something, and I was a bit of in a small way, I was a celebrity. And the people were probably in their 40s, but I thought they were an old couple. And they said, "We'd like to ask you your advice." I mean, they said, "You're making a living in music, and you seem to be enjoying it. We have several children who are in their teens, and all they want to do, particularly one of them, is be a singer and a guitar player, and we don't know what to do. I mean, we don't understand his music. We are hesitant to encourage him to do something where we're pretty sure he can't make a living at it. What do you think?" But people tell us that he's really good. And, I said, "Well, if he's really good, if he's good enough, he's going to do it whether you want him to do it or not, because he has to do it. And maybe he'll make connections, and maybe he'll get lucky, but if he doesn't, he'll have a rich life." I said something like that, I don't know. And it turned out to be James Taylor's parents.
That's funny. So are people generally willing to talk, or does it sometimes take a little bit of persuasion?
I think people, I've done it so long that people are usually willing to talk. Occasionally I have to convince somebody. They'll say, oh, you know, I don't have anything interesting to say. My life has just been regular. And I say, well, that's what I want to hear about, is your day-to-day life. And my joy is when maybe half an hour into the interview, somebody will say, well, you know, maybe my life has been interesting. And I go, yes. Yes.
You got it, yeah. All right, let's hear another clip. This one is from Caroline Hunter, so give us a little bit, a quick introduction to her.
Caroline Hunter is an amazing woman. She is a chemist. She is an anti-apartheid activist, and she's now also a teacher. And she runs, what she's talking about in this clip is talking about the Polar Bears, which is a group of, began as a small group of African Americans who would swim every morning at the Inquil Beach in Oak Bluffs. Now it's grown hugely. We have, you know, there may be sometimes 95 people in the circle that used to be six people, the exercise circle. But she she and her husband took on Polaroid with their involvement in the apartheid movement in South Africa.
Well, I joined the Polar Bear about 86, 87, and so I've been a member ever since. And when I joined, their seniors were leading the exercise group. I've always been impressed with the fact that these are older women who are mobile and whose skin looks good and who have this quality of life and grace and strength. So I said, there's got to be something important to this. And so I joined. And at some point, as the older ones could not anymore, Eleanor Hughes and I took over the exercise group. When we joined, they would sing Wade in the Water to walk in, and we would do the Jacob's Ladder song. That's one of our upper arm exercises. The exercise is physical. We often have young people who come in, and they think, oh, my God, these old ladies, it's not going to be anything too much, and we wear them out. So it's a full exercise. We do some cross-body training. We do cardio. And then sometimes it's fun, sometimes it's social, sometimes it's spiritual, sometimes it's religious, sometimes people bring their troubles to us and leave them with us. And we pray that people treat each other on land the way we treat each other in the water. And now one thing is the full disclosure, I cannot swim. I can tread water. But that feature helps a lot of people get in the water. Because when they say to me, I can't swim, I say, well, I can't swim either. I'm embarrassed that I can't swim, and I think everybody should swim. But as I said, it's amazing the number of people who've been traumatized in water. I can say, okay, well, just come this far with me, and if you don't like it, you'll go out. And at the end of the exercise, you get this spiritual, overwhelming joy of a person saying, I was able to do it. I'm either going to go home and take lessons, or I won't be so afraid.
The island is small, but the population is diverse. What are some of the lesser-known or hidden populations on the vineyard?
Well, that's one of my goals of collecting oral histories, is to reach the people from the diverse populations. And it's a goal of our new museum, too. Our new location museum. For a small island, there's an incredible ethnic diversity of the Wampanoags, African Americans, the Yankees, the Brazilians, the Eastern Europeans, and then Portuguese, and then cultural diversities, a Jewish community, the Buddhist community. There's a lot going on.
Hey, we have a clip from Eladio Falco. Want to tell us anything about this before we hear it?
Sure. He's came to the vineyard about 15 years ago and decided that he wanted to stay here and went through the legal process that took him not 2 years, but 11 years.
Wow.
And so in his piece in the book, he talks about coming to the vineyard, but also about some of the challenges that face immigrants of all kinds to the vineyard and to America.
I think when I first arrived, my lack of communication skills, my English wasn't as good. What made my English better? It was music and movies. That's where I got it from. Because of my love for music, I started reading all the lyrics. You know, I used to sit and put on, you know, Cat Stevens' album or The Stones or whatever it was, and sitting there, and back then you could open and read the lyrics. So I'm singing along with it in my mind. I'm like, oh, so that's what that word sounds like. So most of my English, most from it was music and movies.
Has the immigrant experience changed on the island?
I think it has. I mean, as it has changed in all of America, that, you know, that there was a big influx of Brazilians. Now it's more Eastern Europeans. And, you know, as demographics change, as economies change in different countries, you know, that affects the immigrant flow.
How has this work changed your sense of community or shaped your experience on the island?
Well, it makes me realize, one, how many wonderful, diverse communities there are, and what a strong, lovely community the island is on the whole. There's, you know, stories in the book, like John Athern talking about the cats in West Tisbury, give you a real sense of, you know, what West Tisbury was like in the 60s, where your cat could go into church with you. And, you know, there's very strong, people are independent but fiercely dependent on their neighbors and friends.
Yeah. Our next clip is from June Manning. What do you want to say about June?
June is a genealogist, a historian. She's a Wampanoag, and she is talking about when Gayhead got electricity, which was quite one of the last towns in Massachusetts. So the Vineyard still has this kind of corners of history that existed quite recently on Martha's Vineyard.
It was in February 1951 we finally got electricity in Gayhead, and it was a big to-do in town. Some of the ladies in town put on this skit, and they had like part of the poles in a great big aluminum pan and sand in it, like they were climbing the poles and stringing the wires. And it was funny. I can vividly remember. It was a really nice production. It was wonderful to get electricity. My sister Judith and I were 4 and 3 at the time. And one of the newspapers, either the Boston Globe or the Providence Journal, took a photograph of us looking at a light bulb and like, oh, a new toy, you know? So it was monumental. It was a very big deal. One of the reasons we didn't have electricity was because of the fact that they didn't think that the town could really afford it. Our mother was very involved with the Aquinnah Women's Club. So the Aquinnah Women's Club had penny sales, they had potluck dinners, they did a lot of fundraising to be able to assist in obtaining electricity for Gayhead after we had electricity. What our grandfather did every morning was listen to the fish auction in New Bedford. You know, how much they got paid for each species of fish. It was a routine every morning. Once we had electricity, of course, we had black and white television. And one of our neighbors in East Pasture was Max Eastman. Well, they didn't extend the electricity there for a long time. So every Friday night, Max Eastman, when he was in Gayhead, Max Eastman would come over to our home and watch the fights, the Friday night fights. So it was like having another uncle around. He was just a very, I loved him. He was a giant of a man. Everyone loved him.
That's a good example, that clip, of how simply knowing the date electricity came to place doesn't give you the same insight as hearing the stories of how the event changed people's lives, right?
Definitely. And the fact that the Aquinnah Women's Association could get it together to make it possible.
Yeah. We have another audio clip. This one's from Ann Bassett. You want to tell us about anything about Ann?
Ann Bassett is a vibrant woman who is a MVTV producer, and she was a riding instructor, and she's involved in everything.
And when I grew up, late 40s, early 50s, you pretty much stayed in your own town. You didn't even know people in other towns. The only time we ever saw other kids our age was at basketball games or if you were part of a church group. So that when I became a member of the first graduating class from the regional high school, we entered in 1959 and graduated in 1960, I met kids my age who'd grown up on the island just as I had that I'd never seen before in my life.
Leading up to the establishment of the regional high school, there was a lot of controversy.
Oh, there certainly was. And people hated the idea, hated it. You know how the six towns hold so with a death grip onto their own personalities and autonomy. It was the most threatening thing in the world. We all hated it. We hated the idea of it. Oh, I wasn't going to go. I wasn't going to go. I'd go off island before I'd go to the regional school. A lot of us kids felt that way. Well, it was almost like a betrayal of what you knew and valued. And there was a great deal of sadness that I'd been in one building pretty much, from first grade, and then to have to move and give up. Edgartown wasn't having a high school anymore. It was traumatic. But the state was demanding regionalization, and if you wanted money for your community, this was how you were going to have to do it. And of course, once we got there, we loved it. It was great. There were so many opportunities that hadn't been available to us. I mean, it was a taste of the real world. It was fascinating because, first of all, it was a building with many, many rooms, whereas in Edgartown, there was three grades had their desks in the study hall. And then the freshmen were in Joe Robichaud's room. But you could hear what was going on in the other room. And of course, it was all you wanted to hear was what the big kids were doing. And so here, there were hallways, rooms for all the different classes, but there was also the exhilaration of something new and meeting new people. And of course, at that age, it's all about the dating scene. So, the fact that there were guys that we'd never met before, whoa.
Are these histories archived and searchable?
Yes, we have at the Martha's Vineyard Museum in our library, we have an archive of over 1,700 interviews with people on the island, both the transcripts of those that have been transcribed and also digitized. And you can listen to the audio and you can listen to the different clips that we have made, edited clips. And we try also to integrate the audio into our exhibits at the new museum to kind of enhance the experience of...
Have you included your own story?
No.
That's when we have to get. All right, we have a final clip. This is Everett Poole. What do you want to say about Everett?
Everett Poole is Everett Poole of Poole's Fish Market. He's a fish dealer. He's the Chilmark moderator at all the meetings. He's a wonderful man.
38 hurricane the next morning when it was all over. They shut Menemsha off. Only the fishermen could get down there, and we were down there trying to salvage stuff. There were, it seemed like hundreds of people waiting at Menemsha Road and guys with shotguns telling them they couldn't come down there.
Your father's boathouse, did those get blown away?
Oh, those were demolished, yeah. They were demolished, so were most of the boats. All the docks were washed out. In the 38 hurricane, I think the only boathouse that was left was Bill Hand's, which was a two-story one. Everything... All along the harbor, the only thing that was left was Carl Reed's store, but it just took everything else. The 38 changed the whole waterfront. For probably 2 months afterwards, it was common practice, anything you found afloat or ashore on the beach or anything, that you weren't sure who it belonged to, you would bring it and dump it by Carl Reed's store. And there was a whole pile of stuff there. Guys would come along and go through it, see if any of their stuff was there, and then they'd find somebody going off with somebody else's stuff. I can remember a big pile of oars and oarlocks and bailers and life jackets and you name it, it was there, lobster pots. And Rodney Dutcher, he was a reporter for the New York Times, and he started a collection for the fishermen. And the Red Cross kicked in some money. That's why the yacht part of the bulkhead is called Dutcher Dock.
That's a Everett Poole story reminds us that despite all that has changed since the hurricane of 38, we're still at the mercy of weather. And in the wake of a hurricane, we might even be facing many of the same challenges. So kind of it's a cliche, but learning from the past does help us prepare for the future, doesn't it?
It does. A lot. It does.
The book is Vineyard Voices, Three Words, Faces, and Voices of Island People by Lindsay Lee. The Martha's Vineyard Museum is featuring portraits of the subjects of Vineyard Voices 3, along with accompanying audio through August 11th. We'll post a link with more information about the book and the exhibit at the museum at our website, capeandislands.org. Lindsay Lee, thanks for joining us. It's always good to see you.
Thank you. Great to be here.